I grew up attending old-time gospel meetings, and as a child, I remember lying on a pallet under an old brush arbor with gas lanterns all around behind the old Bit Shop church building out north of Healton, Oklahoma, listening to such preachers as Brother James R. Stewart, Homer King, H.E. Robertson, Homer A. Gay, H.C. Harper, J.D. Phillips, and locally, Brother Tommy Smith. And at the close of the meeting, the members always brought lunch and spread dinner on the ground. And so far as I know, there were never any questions about the propriety of that. It always seemed like the perfect way to end a gospel meeting. Of course, the fact that we did it and we enjoyed it does not address the question of whether it was the scriptural thing to do. I know also some places in the South, there were those who opposed eating in the church, meaning the church house. And at some places, they had preaching on Sunday in the afternoon, as well as the morning worship and the evening service. They justified dinner on the ground upon the idea that it would be too much to go home after the morning service, come back for the afternoon, and then go back home and come back for the night service. Now, with some, to have dinner together just to enjoy one another's company and get to know one another would have been unthinkable. In fact, one congregation built a shelter to use in inclement weather, and some members of another congregation complained that on one occasion that congregation had ice cream together when there was not a meeting going on. You know, I don't think we ever thought anything was wrong with eating together until congregations began putting kitchens in the church house. After all, what could be wrong with church members eating together? And what's more, didn't we read about love feasts in the early church? One digressive preacher argued that the apostolic church enjoyed common meals called love feasts based on 2 Peter 2:13 and Jude 12. And with this slim reed for proof, he attempts to justify the modern fellowship meal conducted in a fellowship hall provided by church funds where members could have birthday parties, anniversary celebrations, baby showers, bake sales, rummage sales to raise funds for benevolent institutions, eat social meals, and so forth. Now, the problem for me when I look at these two scriptures that this preacher used, I'm unable to see what he purports to see. Let's look at these passages for a moment. 2 Peter 2:13, "And shall receive the reward of unrighteousness as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Spots they are, and blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings while they feast with you." Then there's Jude 12. "These are spots in your feasts of charity, when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds they are without water, carried about of winds. Trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots." From simply reading that first scripture, we cannot tell whether sporting themselves with their own deceivings while they feast with you refers to social eating, separate and apart from congregational provisions, or whether that's church funded. Now, we would certainly have to know this beyond the shadow of a doubt before we could make the argument for churches providing a place for parties and potlucks and so forth. Now, the term love feast occurs only one time in the Bible, talking about the King James Version, and that is here in Jude 12. And it is translated from the word agapea. Thayer defines the word as love feast and then describes that as feasting, a feast expressing and fostering mutual love, which used to be held by Christians before the celebration of the Lord's Supper and at which the poorer Christians mingled with wealthier and partook in common with the rest of the food provided at the expense of the wealthy. Now, one of the problems with this is that Thayer lists Acts 20 and 7 as an example of a love feast. Now, if this is a love feast, then it's not the Lord's Supper, and there's no specified time at which the Lord's Supper is to be observed. Now, the commentators are not agreed upon love feast. In fact, Albert Barnes states, the reference is probably to the Lord's Supper, called a feast or festival of love, because it revealed the love of Christ to the world. On the other hand, James McKnight, usually a very cautious commentator, states the primitive Christians were used to feast together before they celebrated the Lord's Supper because it was instituted by Christ after he had eaten the Passover with his disciples. See 1 Corinthians 11, 21. And he says these previous suppers were called, Jude verse 13, agape, a love feast, because the rich, by feasting their poor brethren, expressed their love to them. Jude 12, verse 12, note 12, 2. Barnes continues, however, there can be no doubt that such a custom early existed in the Corinthian church and extensively prevailed. But it can be readily accounted for without supposing that it had the sanction of the apostles or that it existed in their time. He explains, quote, festivals prevailed among the Jews, and it would not be unnatural to introduce them into the Christian church. And then he continues again, the custom prevailed among the heathen of having a feast upon a sacrifice or in connection with a sacrifice. And as the Lord's Supper commemorated the great sacrifice for sin, it was not unnatural in imitation of the heathen to append a feast or festival to that ordinance, either before or after its celebration. Now, I could spend my time reading comments from early church history, but I can tell you there's no unanimity on love feasts or what they really were. Some consider it a name for the Lord's Supper. Others think it referred to meals that the Christians ate together in their own homes. Others feel it referred to some kind of a feast for the poor, such as Christ recommended in Luke 14, 12, and 13. We do know that Ignatius, who lived 30 to 107 A.D., Clement of Alexandria, 153 to 200 A.D., Tertullian, 145 200 A.D., and others wrote of love feasts in the early church. But in no way does that prove like they were anything what is being called love feasts today. Our concern, friends, is not what early history teaches. Our concern is whether we are in harmony with the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. Among the brethren who have digressed from the apostolic teaching and tradition, there's a great effort made to justify fellowship halls. From what we read in history about feasts originating among the Jews and the heathen, it seems those who are trying to justify church banqueting in church fellowship halls are making the same mistake as some did after the close of the apostolic era. They were trying to Christianize some of the customs they had picked up somewhere other than the authority of Christ and the apostles. They make some assumptions in an effort to justify fellowship halls. They assume that love feast refers to social meals that would include parties, showers, promotions for benevolent causes, and so forth. But as I've shown, the only occurrence of the phrase love feast in the Bible is Jude 12, and as we know, the verse or the context must contain something upon which to base such a claim. Now, they assume that fellowship in the Bible has reference to parties, get-togethers, showers, social meals, games, and so forth. Someone said one time, when I hear the word fellowship, I smell coffee. Well, you know, it's not unusual to hear a brother say at the close of a service, well, if you're a visitor, hang around for some fellowship. Well, if you're talking about fellowship and as it's described in the Bible, you won't smell any coffee. Fellowship always has a spiritual meaning in the Scriptures. Now, of course, I might get me a modern dictionary and find the word defined to include social gatherings, entertainment, banqueting. But we need to be sure we're using that word as it was used in the first century. And that's the mistake our denominational friends make when looking into a modern dictionary to define the meaning of baptism or Christian. It's not the same, is it? Now, they assume that it's the work of the church to provide social meals and other forms of entertainment for its members. And somewhere in the past, the idea arose that it would be all right to take the funds collected on the first day of the week for the four saints and the support of the gospel and construct a church building that would include such things as a kitchen and a dining area and a fellowship hall. These things were not done to feed needy saints. They were built to feed and entertain already well-fed members. At one point among our brethren who employ Sunday school and individual cups and other innovations, they considered it a sin to have fellowship halls. In fact, in 1951, B.C. Goodpasture, who was then the editor of the Gospel Advocate, wrote in the Gospel Advocate annual lesson commentary and said, I quote, "It is not the mission of the church to furnish entertainment or amusement for the world or even for its own members. Innocent amusement in proper proportion has its place in the life of all normal persons, but it is not the business of the church to furnish it. The church was not established to feature athletics. For the church to turn aside from its divine work to furnish amusement and recreation is to pervert its mission. It is to degrade its mission. Building recreation rooms and providing and supervising recreational activities at the expense of the church is a departure from the simple gospel plan as revealed in the New Testament. The church might as well relieve the parents of feeding and disciplining all the young people at church expense as to take over the job of entertaining and supervising the recreation at church expense." Now, it is argued, of course, that that's an end of the quote. It is argued that churches that build kitchens, dining rooms, gyms, and such things grow. Of course, that may be true, but there's a certain kind of growth that teaches you're on the wrong road. Read Matthew 7 and verse 13. We might also say that churches that teach premillennialism, Calvinism, and operation of the Holy Spirit also grow, don't they? In fact, they grow faster, more universally, than the ones who merely opt for fellowship halls. It's argued that building fellowship halls is a good work. However, the Bible defines what is a good work over in 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17. And nowhere in the Bible do we find approval for church-sponsored social meals, recreation, or fellowship halls. But some things are as mandatory for church growth, we're told. Irvin Himmel wrote in the Old Gospel, the Guardian of Truth, I should say, and stated, and I quote again, "The Jerusalem church had no youth minister, no family life center, no activities director, no daycare center, no choir, no band, no orchestra, no music minister. It had no soccer field, no gymnasium. It had no marriage counselor, no seniors ministry, and no chariot ministry," whatever that is. You know, modern liberals make the first century churches look like they weren't on the cutting edge of things. They make the apostles look like back numbers, apathetic, unspiritual, lacking vision, because they never advocated such ideas. In fact, liberalism is forced to condemn the Christianity that was practiced in the first century, because it was completely void of all the things that people today say the church can't do without and survive. When we oppose such liberalism, there are some who charge that we believe the building is sacred, God's temple. No, the issue is not eating in the building. Rather, it is where the church can build fellowship halls designed for such things as baby showers, birthday parties, games, common meals, and such. Now, there may be times when such as benevolence, I would say, when eating in the church building would become a part of the church's work. In fact, such occasions as Acts 6 and 2 and Acts 11, 29 and 30 might include that. But you know, most of the time, that's not the case, is it? Liberal brethren have argued that eating in the building, that is the issue, rather than churches funding and maintaining facilities for social meals, parties, and so forth, misnamed fellowship halls. One such liberal preacher knew of a case where brethren were building a meeting place and had lunch in the partially completed structure. He said the day they moved into the facility, eating on the premises became a sin. Of course, he didn't address using money from the Lord's treasury to erect kitchens and banquet halls for social meals, birthday, anniversary parties, baby showers, and so forth. Well, this brought about some parallels that would not sit well with the other brother. Imagine a Christian church preacher relating this incident. The writer knows of a case where brethren were involved in building a church building. As they took a break on the premises, one of them whipped out his harmonica and played a tune. And then the day they moved into the facility to worship, playing instrumental music became a sin. Of course, you can also parallel that with a baptistry. Let's say while they were building the church, one of the children jumped in the baptistry and paddled around. And of course, the day that the church moved into the building, such thing would be wrong. Well, you see, such arguments are designed to spread prejudice against those who oppose family halls and family life centers and such things as that. Well, I don't want to be misunderstood, because I don't for one moment suggest that it is wrong for brethren to eat together. It is not wrong. We encourage all Christians to use their opportunities to share time with brethren outside the worship assembly. I do not say there is no benefit to be derived from brethren eating common meals together. There is. There's joy. There's appreciation. There's caring. There is trust. There's sharing that comes from such occasions. But I simply say this. The New Testament gives no scriptural basis to any church of Christ, to plan, promote, provide food, fun, frolic, that is commonly defined as fellowship. Now, the proper oversight of and provisions for meals that feed the body is given to the individual Christian within the context of home. On such occasions that we are together, it is an extension of the hospitality of the home. And the proper oversight and provisions for the meal that feeds the soul is given to the local church within the context of the assembly of the saints. I read somewhere years ago that the early church met and fasted together, but I think the modern church meets and feasts together. I become concerned about the future of the church when all we can think about is food, fun, frolic. And this is evident sometimes when the flyers and meeting announcements are mailed out and provide a list of all the activities that will be engaged in during the meeting. I don't know, it seems like an inducement from the church, an appeal, if you will, to lure those who might not come if it's just to hear the gospel. Maybe I'm an old timer, but I wonder about the prudence of bringing coffee pots, cookers into the church building, as some have said, putting them under the chairs during morning worship, so as to appeal to our sense of smell and thirst and get our minds off of the purpose that we're there for. I certainly don't want to offend any of the good brothers and sisters who work so hard to make a meeting a great success. But some have noted comments made as people come in with dishes and desserts about how good they look and smell. One time, Brother Linwood Smith was holding a meeting at Ardmore, Oklahoma, my home congregation. We were standing in the entry greeting people, as he always liked to do. One of our fringe members came in, and she passed by, someone said something about expecting to hear a good sermon. She said, "It's that dinner I want to get to." Well, later Linwood said to me, he said, "That woman's kind of coarse, isn't she?" Well, what do you think Paul would say about such a thing? Do you think Paul might say, "If any man hunger, let him eat at home"? And speaking of Linwood, let me tell you that although he believed in young people behaving themselves, they had no better friend or encourager in this world than he. He heard some young person ask one time about a meeting, I think it might have been the 4th of July meeting, says, "What are the young folks going to do?" Linwood said, "Well, I'll tell you what the young folks are going to do. They're going to come into this services and sit on front seats and act like young ladies and gentlemen." And I think that he was never so happy as when that occurred. I have made a mistake today. I had some other notes that I wanted to mention, but apparently I picked up the wrong set. That comes from rearranging and advising after you have already thought you had your lesson under control. There's a lot of questions that can be asked and also answered about these meetings. And I want to find one place here where we have some of those questions. Let's see. If I sound a little bit unprepared, you're right about that. I realize that there are some questions that can be raised toward both things that we mentioned. And I'm not opposed to eating together. But I do not believe it's the mission of the church to build places where that is the case. Well, I don't find it, but here's some of the questions that perhaps we could address. First of all, is Jude 12 referring to fellowship meals provided by first century churches as part of their congregational work? Can we find in this verse the modern fellowship meal which has become the custom in many churches of Christ? Did early churches of Christ provide social meals for the sake of generating, promoting, and enhancing love among the brethren? Does the New Testament of Jesus Christ endorse, encourage, and entitle churches to provide such love feasts today? The answer to many conservative brethren is no. Nothing in the context of Jude 12 compels us to conclude that love feasts are the ancient counterpart to modern-day fellowship meals arranged and offered by churches. Now, as I have said, I think if it is plain that what we offer is simply an extension of the fellowship of our individual homes, then I see nothing wrong with that. Because when he says in 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, I presume that you've already addressed that today, but there's some things that are said there that would seem like it would be impossible if all eating was forbidden. For example, what about eating, let's say, with brethren in a restaurant? Does the passage still read the same, mean the same, when it says, if any man hunger, let him eat at home? Is there a limit to where we can eat? What about a place where the church has worshiped, such as an upper room, where Paul in Acts the 20th chapter, I think verse 11, McGarvey argues that that was the communion, which if it was, of course, is a different story. But if that was simply Paul, then he was eating a meal in a place where they had just had worship. So there's questions that can be answered, and I think maybe we should address those. You probably have some questions that you would like to ask, and I would be glad. And I want to mention one other thing. And that is over here in 2 Peter 2 and 13, where Peter writes to the saints, you will see that he varies from probably some of the modern translations. In 2 Peter 2 and verse 13, he says, and shall receive the reward of unrighteousness, excuse me, as they that count it pleasure to ride in the daytime, spots they are and blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings. I had a quote from Dr. Kelly, who wrote a commentary on 2 Peter and some of the other small books. But he points out that that word deceivings is translated in the newer translations as love feasts. And that's because the word for love feast is a form of the word agape. Agapes is a plural. And deceivings is A-P-A-I-S, apates. And so he claims that the only one who could be in variation from what Jude wrote was Peter himself, and that he did it in order to show the terrible nature of these things that they were doing. Evidently, it was just a riotous occasion. Evidently, there were things going on there in that love feast that were terrible and bad. In fact, if you read much in the comments from the commentators on that, you will see that he goes ahead to say, while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin, being a beguiling unstable souls, a heart, they have exercised with covetous practices, cursed children, false teachers, promoting love feasts, while they are sporting themselves with their own deceivings, Peter says. So there's only a one-letter change. In fact, if you read Unschel's manuscripts, which are capitals, it looks almost the same. But if that's the case, if Peter varied from Jude on that particular point, then he was trying to point out the error that was involved in these love feasts. Well, I'm through, essentially, with what I had to say, and I realize that this may not be satisfactory to a lot of people, but I brought up some of the things that I wonder about. You know, I think if it takes frolic and fun and such things to induce young people and others, old people for that matter, to attend gospel meetings, then we are underestimating the power of the gospel. And I think we should give serious consideration to how we word our announcements and how we plan our activities and so forth. Now, I'm not opposed to having entertainment, but I don't believe it's the business of the church to furnish that. I'm not opposed to having exercises and young people playing games and such things, like that, but it's not the business of the church to organize and to do that. And these fellowship halls that now are prominent among the digressive brethren is not enough. They're finding that they also need family life centers, which, if you wrote the word up there, that really it's what it is, it's a gym. And I certainly have my serious doubts about anything like that being conducive to spirituality. You know, there was a time when brethren loved to hear gospel preaching, when they'd drive miles to support a gospel meeting, when the fervor of the gospel was so great that we wanted to be together to sing and to pray and to promote the church. And I would glad to see that day come again. I'm through, Glenn, if you want to open for some questions.
Johnny, I agree with everything you said. I believe that's right. We had a situation a few years ago. Many of them here know that I live in Weatherford and go to church over at Mineral Wells. We had a lady, member of the church there for several years, would not eat at the building at all because of what 1 Corinthians 11 says. I addressed this in a lesson one time and pointed out that, well, you know, a lot of the early churches met in their homes. Aquila and Priscilla had a congregation meeting in their homes. So the question was, would they not be allowed to eat in their own home after service was over? Well, after I explained that, well, the lady realized that just eating in the building after service is over is not a problem, and she changed her views on that. And in reference to the other things you're saying, according to Acts 8 and verse 4, the early church went everywhere. They were scattered abroad, went everywhere preaching the word. Walmart has a drawing card. Two of them, primarily. They've got their low prices, and they've got that gas station out front that sells cheap gas. You and I remember years ago, Safeways and other grocery stores would have bread on sale real cheap, or milk, a gallon of milk, a real low price, and that was their drawing card, what they used to get them there. Now, my question is, if you will agree with this, I believe that the drawing card of the church is to be the gospel. Now, when we begin to use other things to draw people to the church, I don't believe we're going to be drawing faithful Christians. I believe personally that if we use the drawing card of the gospel, then we're going to draw Christians. And I believe we'll save ourselves a lot of headache down the road, because we could get a lot of people to come to church, but that doesn't mean they're going to turn out to be faithful Christians and a real benefit to the church, and could turn out to be problems. That's my question. Do you believe that the drawing card of the church is the gospel, both what we preach and what we live out in our lives? That's my question.
Well, I certainly do, and you know, I know some of the old-time preachers that didn't even want the preacher's name in bold letters because they said the drawing power is to be the gospel, not the preacher, not the man, not the famous person, but the gospel.